really doesn't matter whether President Trump signs the bill or not.
Oh, this economist says the U.S. will most likely make the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act law. This is Thursday, the 28th of November, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Also ahead, some of the victims of the slaughter of some migrants in the U.K. are returned to Vietnam. This is Thanksgiving in the United States. We'll explore how many are celebrating. And we continue our series of reports on what impeachment is all about in this country. It all comes your way on today's VOA Asia. One of the few bipartisan measures to appear before the U.S. Congress of late has been passage of the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act. The almost unanimous vote in both the U.S. House and Senate required the U.S. government to impose sanctions against Chinese and Hong Kong officials responsible for human rights abuses in Hong Kong, and required the United States State Department and other agencies to conduct an annual review to determine whether changes in Hong Kong's political status, meaning its relationship with mainland China, justify changing the unique favorable trade relations between the U.S. and Hong Kong. The measure is now before President Donald Trump. He faces what appears to be a difficult decision for him. On one hand, he expresses support for Hong Kong protesters, at least most of them. On the other, he says his negotiators are close to agreement with China on an initial agreement on trade. Joining us on VOA Asia is Jeff Moon, former assistant trade representative for China in the Obama administration and now president of China Moon Strategies, LLC. He joins us via Skype. Jeff, tell us more about the U.S., what the U.S. president is facing.
Well, he's facing a dilemma of his own creation. Unlike his predecessors, President Trump introduced the art of the deal, where he has brought unrelated issues into the trade discussions in order to gain leverage. And so Xi Jinping is now returning the favor by trying to bring unrelated issues into the trade dispute. You know, previously, we would just say, this is not about trade. We're not going to talk about it. Having said that, it really doesn't matter whether President Trump signs the bill or not. If he does not sign it, if he does nothing, after 10 days, it becomes law under the U.S. Constitution. If he vetoes it, Congress will almost certainly override him, and Ted Cruz, one of the conservatives, and others have openly threatened that. Congress passed the bill by almost unanimous consent. Only one person dissented. So Congress is certainly going to vote this in, and he's going to have to face the consequences with regard to the trade war no matter what. Xi Jinping also faces a dilemma of his own creation, and that is that he and the Chinese government have promoted a false narrative for many months now that the U.S. government is behind the protests. The elections, of course, over the weekend proved that that's not true. But he has created this expectation that he may strike back at the United States after all this time. And so he's trying to use the trade war as perhaps an instance where he can show that he's taking resolute action on this and, in addition, gain some negotiating leverage. I think in the end, what's going to happen is that this will not significantly affect the trade war, that the trade war is important enough to both countries that they need to find a resolution. It's causing enough damage to both economies, and the agreement that they are about to reach is, quite frankly, modest enough. It doesn't even address the main issues in the trade war. It's modest enough that they should and can reach it, and it will be modestly helpful to both countries if they do so. So I think Xi Jinping will find a way to respond to the U.S. in a way that doesn't involve the trade war, but nonetheless expresses some kind of displeasure. And President Trump needs to help him try to find that kind of a solution to this impasse.
Do the Chinese have to find a way to save face, or do they have one?
I think they do need to find a way to save face, because it's all about the nature of the conflict over Hong Kong. For the Chinese, Hong Kong is about sovereignty and reassuming sovereignty after what they call a century of humiliation. For the U.S., this is about human rights. I mean, that's something quite different. So for China, I think this is actually a much more important issue. Hong Kong is a much more important issue than the trade war is. So they will need to have to find some way to save face. And frankly, their policy has been failing for many months. and they are looking for a way to shift blame also for that failed policy, and they have sort of created the narrative that the United States is the place where that blame should be shifted.
If this chapter number one of any reported trade agreement does go through, how much is that going to accomplish? How much further do the two sides have to go?
Well, it will be important for the U.S. because farmers are hurting, and they will, according to the president, receive $40 to $50 billion in sales of U.S. agricultural products. From the Chinese perspective, they need to buy the agricultural goods that are on the table here. They need the soybeans, they need the pork, and the other things are there. So this is entirely in their interests to do this. The question is over tariffs, how much tariffs will be affected, and that's probably one of the final sticking points here. However, those issues are important, and getting a deal would be a very good thing. But the entire USTR complaint that was filed a year and a half ago is not addressed in this agreement. We're not talking about the practice of forcing mandatory joint ventures or subsidies or cyber hacking or other regulations that are overbroad and tilt the playing field. We're not talking about Huawei. We're not talking about a variety of emerging issues and in regulations that are not coming up, they're going to hamper trade. So there is an awful lot that's going to be left on the table. The question in my mind is, you know, it has been so incredibly difficult to reach this agreement, which touches on all the easy issues. So will they really ever be able to get to the more difficult issues? And I think that it's more likely, it's not so likely that they will actually get to those, what they're calling phase two issues, by the time of the election next year.
Well, without that happening, what happens as far as China's relationship and China's ideas about what to do about Hong Kong?
Well, Hong Kong is a separate issue from the trade agreement. And Hong Kong, the real problem here is preserving autonomy in Hong Kong. China committed in 1984 in the joint statement with Britain that it would preserve Hong Kong's autonomy. And at the time of the reversion, the basic law also reinforces that. The U.S. Hong Kong Policy Act of 1982 also reinforces Hong Kong's autonomy. The question is whether, independent of the trade situation, whether China will grant Hong Kong the autonomy that it promised or whether it will continue to reduce that autonomy. Everyone agrees that China has sovereignty over Hong Kong. Everyone agrees that the formula going forward is one country, two systems. The question is whether China will allow that second system to have the autonomy that it promised 20 years ago.
But one has to think that Beijing does not want another Tiananmen Square.
Of course not. And I think that you see that in the way that they've been trying to manage it. They have been trying to manage it without resorting to those kind of tactics. And I think that they've also been trying to manage it locally, although there has been somewhat of a Chinese presence now coming into the force that's out there. I don't think that's a result that anyone is looking for, and I think everyone's trying to avoid that. But I think a lot of people are hoping that China will listen to the message that was sent last weekend in the Hong Kong district elections and perhaps moderate or not increase the pressure that it's putting on the Hong Kong people.
Thank you, Jeff Moon. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now at voanews.com. Analysts say a provocative North Korean artillery exercise near its border with the South may represent a stepped-up campaign to try and force the United States to end what it sees as hostile policies ahead of its self-declared year-end deadline. A special anti-terrorism tribunal in Bangladesh has sentenced seven members of a banned Islamist militant group to death for plotting an attack on a restaurant in Dhaka in which 22 people, mostly foreigners, were killed. A search for pro-democracy protesters still hiding in Hong Kong's Polytechnic University came up empty on Wednesday as academic authorities prepared to clean up following a near two-week siege of the campus. You're listening to VOA Asia. The bodies of some of the Vietnamese who died when human traffickers carried them by truck to England last month were repatriated to their homeland Wednesday and have been taken to their families. AP's Charles Ledesma has more.
The bodies of some of the victims found in a British truck are being repatriated to Vietnam. The bodies of 16 of the 39 Vietnamese who died when human traffickers carried them by truck to England last month have been flown back to their homeland and are being taken to their families. One father of an 18-year-old victim says he had been informed by a local government official that his son's remains will be brought home Wednesday, along with six other victims. The man told the AP, "I'm devastated, but I'll be happy to have him back with us soon." I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Happening now in Asia, a roadside bomb in northern Afghanistan demolished a civilian vehicle Wednesday evening, killing at least 15 civilians and injuring two others. Provincial officials said the victims, including women and children, were on their way to attend a wedding party. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We continue now. Many new refugees in America experience culture shock when they first arrive in the United States. Many have to deal with a new language, culture, and even holidays. But settled refugees can play a big role in helping new arrivals adapt to life in the U.S. One example is the Ethiopian Community Center, which hosts a Thanksgiving meal every year for new refugees. VOA's Shanaz Nafis has more on the event.
For newly arrived refugees in United States, a Thanksgiving get-together may be as foreign as this live Irish dance performance. This annual Thanksgiving holiday aims to help refugees adjust to life and the many cultures in America. The Ethiopian community hosted this gathering just outside Washington, D.C. The refugees here come mostly from war-torn countries like Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan.
Today we enjoy about the Thanksgiving party, and all of the people, especially Afghans, coming in this party.
I like Thanksgiving. I greet everyone who are here, and I thank God for America people for everything we give us today.
This event is especially meaningful for Babu Adu, who fled Nigeria 4 years ago to escape violence in his homeland.
My background as a refugee, that means a lot to me because I look around and I see a lot of different faces and cultures, and I got very emotional.
4 years ago, Adu's life was full of challenges when he started his new life in the United States. The Ethiopian Community Development Council helped Babu resettle in Virginia. But organizers say in actuality, the entire community pitches in.
The whole idea is to introduce our refugees to the larger community so that there will be an opportunity to know, to learn from one another.
Some volunteers simply to help people feel welcomed.
I love to welcome new people to our community and to bring in and accept everyone. And I wanted to share a Thanksgiving is to sit down and bring families from all over the place together to share a meal.
Many say they are thankful to have fled their troubled homelands, but also hope one day they will be reunited with their loved ones.
My brother is in Nigeria, and I've not seen him for 4 years. That is, sometimes I get sad when I think about it, but, you know, I would love for him to come here and join me, yeah?
Shanaz Nafis, VOA News, Arlington, Virginia.
Coming up, pardon me, said the turkey. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. With VOA Asia, also follow radio program hosts VOA Stevenson and VOA Melman. VOA Asia Twitter. We're always online for you.
Good This news from VOA Asia. In an historic first, Pakistan's Supreme Court Wednesday raised questions about the legality of extending the term of the army chief, sending shockwaves through a country that has been ruled by the military for more than half of its 72-year existence, and in which the military is considered the most powerful institution. This is VOA Asia. U.S. President Donald Trump has followed a White House Thanksgiving tradition by pardoning Butter, the turkey, and his alternate, Bread. The president also honored his own tradition of cracking jokes while granting clemency to the poultry. White House correspondent Patsy Whitakaswara has the story.
Butter, I wish you a lot of luck, but I hereby grant you a full and complete pardon.
Honoring a White House tradition, President Donald Trump pardoned Butter, the turkey, and his alternate Bread from their fate of being served at Thanksgiving dinner. And Trump cracked jokes about impeachment, noting that the birds have been raised to remain calm under any condition.
Which will be very important because they've already received subpoenas to appear in Adam Schiff's basement on Thursday.
In last year's pardon, Trump also referenced congressional investigations on presidential actions.
Even though peas and carrots have received a presidential pardon, I have warned them that House Democrats are likely to issue them both subpoenas.
In 2017, Trump joked that he would not overturn the pardon given by his predecessor, President Barack Obama.
I have been informed by the White House Counsel's office that Tater and Tot's pardons cannot, under any circumstances, be revoked.
Trump is not the first president to gobble up turkey satire.
You are hereby pardoned.
Recently, I've been taking a series of executive actions that don't require congressional approval. Well, here's another one.
Not surprising, since in these events, presidents get to lighten up and show who they are as a person, said White House historian Matthew Costello.
President Trump is also aware of things in the press and how he's covered. So I think he sees it as an opportunity then to sort of, tease and make fun of some of those things.
Pardoning turkeys has been a presidential tradition since George H.W. Bush in 1989, but the custom has earlier roots. In 1865, Abraham Lincoln pardoned a turkey from the Christmas dinner. In 1863, John F. Kennedy decided to spare one from his Thanksgiving table. And in 1987, Ronald Reagan pardoned Charlie as he deflected questions about the Iran-Contra scandal.
Mr. President, will you participate in the impeachment hearing next week?
After pardoning the turkey, the President and First Lady Melania Trump departed the White House to spend the holiday at his Florida golf resort. Patsy Whitakaswara, VOA News at the White House.
This news break from VOA Asia. Thailand's government Wednesday reversed a planned ban on glyphosate and delayed the imposition of bans on two other chemicals used in agricultural pesticides, citing adverse effects on farmers, industry, and international trade. You are listening to VOA Asia. Donald Trump faces a process that could end with his removal as president of the United States. Impeachment hearings underway now in the House of Representatives represent the beginning part of what is prescribed by the U.S. Constitution. In today's installment of American Impeachment, VOA Steve Reddish explains one of the more vague aspects of impeachment, high crimes and misdemeanors.
There is just one mention in the U.S. Constitution about the criteria for impeaching and removing a president. Article 2, Section 4 of the Constitution reads, "The president shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors." Treason and bribery are specific crimes. But those last four words, high crimes and misdemeanors, provoke the most debate. The phrase comes from British law, putting impeachment of high-level public officials beyond statutory laws.
It was an important feature because one of the things the framers of the Constitution really wanted to make sure is that they didn't have another king.
Constitution signer and interpreter Alexander Hamilton said the nature of impeachment is political, necessary for offenses that stem from what he called the abuse or violation of some public trust. Nearly two centuries later, Congressman and future President Gerald Ford, who became president in 1974 after Richard Nixon quit before potentially being impeached, said an impeachable offense is whatever the majority of the House of Representatives considers it to be at a given moment in history.
It doesn't have to be necessarily a crime in the law books. If a president just simply played golf all day or watched television all day or just didn't do president's job, many think that would be an abuse of his office and worth removing him from.
Four of the 45 U.S. presidents faced an impeachment inquiry. Andrew Johnson was impeached for defying Congress by firing the Secretary of War. Richard Nixon resigned before the House of Representatives could vote on articles of impeachment that accused him of obstructing the investigation of a burglary at the opposing political party headquarters in the Watergate Hotel. Bill Clinton was impeached for lying about a sexual affair with a White House intern, but remained as president because while the House of Representatives voted to impeach Clinton, the Senate acquitted him in a trial in 1999. Donald Trump faces an impeachment vote for his conduct of foreign policy, pressuring the Ukrainian government to investigate a political rival. Rules for the road ahead are vague, determined by the politicians in charge of the U.S. Congress. Steve Reddish, VOA News.
You can hear the next segment of Professor Reddish's diatribe, actually his explanation, tomorrow at the same time. Polluted streams in West Virginia may prove an unexpected source of key minerals used in modern tech, from mobile phones to military hardware. VOA Steve Barragona takes a look.
Roughly 4,000 kilometers of West Virginia streams are orange from pollution called acid mine drainage.
So all the sand around here has that orange cast to it, so it gets a lot of iron.
Paul Zimkevich heads the West Virginia University Water Research Institute. He says water draining from the region's old coal mines turns the streams that color. It's as acidic as vinegar, and it kills fish and insects.
100% fatal. It's bad, bad.
Zimkevich has spent the last 30 years trying to clean up acid mine drainage. But he recently discovered that treating it produces an unexpected bonus.
So when you treat acid mine drainage, the thing you do is you raise the pH of the water and you also oxidize it. Chemically, that causes the transition metals to fall out of solution. They become something we call sludge, generally orange. But it turns out that's also where the rare earth elements went.
Rare earth elements make some key modern tech work, like the magnets in wind turbines and cell phone speakers.
If you were using a conventional iron magnet in your cell phone would be like a brick, for example. You can miniaturize things.
Fighter jets, night vision gear, and other military hardware rely on rare earths. But most of the U.S. supply comes from China. That's a problem when the two countries are in a trade war. Scarcity is not the problem with rare earths, despite the name. Coal and other minerals contain them, but in very low concentrations. They dissolve in acid, though, which is why Zimkevich found them in acid mine drainage.
It's basically letting nature do for free what you would have to do with a great deal of time, effort, and money.
Zimkevich and his colleagues have developed a way to purify the rare earth elements from those polluted streams.
So it separates continuously the rare earth elements and leaves the junk behind.
He says acid mine drainage could produce at least 1,000 tons of these critical minerals out of the roughly 10,000 tons the United States uses each year. And the money provides an incentive to clean up more waterways.
You can't sell the water, but you can certainly sell the rare earth product. And if you can use that to pay for lime, pay for the people who operate the plants, and improve your infrastructure and treat more streams, then this is how you have to go.
His lab just received $5 million from the Department of Energy to scale up his system at a new acid mine drainage treatment plant nearby. Steve Barragona, VOA News, outside Morgantown, West Virginia.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. Thanks for being with us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter. Nelson Lopes is at the controls. Our managing editor is Diane Gao, and our team consists of Jim Stevenson, Keith Lane, and our interns, Hai Young and Candace. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a wonderful day and happy Thanksgiving.